This is the Victoria Falls Study Day, November 2011. Our brother David Lawrence is with us from Prince George, speaking to us to the theme of turning points. This is our third class for the day, entitled The Spies, and our reading to introduce this class was taken from Numbers chapter 14, verses 26 to 29. Brother David, please.
This turning point is going to cause the death of a whole generation. And it's going to be felt for many years in the congregation of Israel. And what the problem is in this section that we're going to be looking at with the spies, the 10 who brought back the evil report and the 2 that brought back the good report, what we really want to see in this is vision. Being able to see the real from the fake, what is true and what is false. There's a New Testament reference that I'd like to start with this concept of seeing the invisible. And it's at the end of 2 Corinthians chapter 4. And you're well aware of these verses. You've probably read them and worked with them a number of times. But I think the vision which is described to us in the last 2 verses of 2 Corinthians chapter 4 is the epitome of the 2 men that brought back the good report. They could see the invisible. And that's what we are asked to do. The tangible, the stuff you can touch and feel, is ephemeral. It's passing away. It's not going to last. We have to see the invisible, the things which cannot be seen with the naked eye. You can't see love. You can't give someone a pound of love. It's a quality. It's an intangible substance. Well, those are the kind of qualities which God asks us to see and make real and manifest them in our lives. And those last 2 verses of 2 Corinthians chapter 4 speak to this. Verse 17 of 2 Corinthians 4, "For our light affliction, which is but for a moment, worketh for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory, while we look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal." That's the vision that our God asks us to have. Just don't look at the stuff that you can see here and the stuff you can touch and feel. See beyond that. Look beyond. It talks about our light affliction, which is but for a moment. Now, it doesn't seem like that. Now, when you are in the swamp and it's supposed to be drained and the alligators are nibbling at your extremities, you forget a little bit about what you're really supposed to be doing. And we do. We forget what we're supposed to be doing. We're supposed to be manifesting and reflecting the character of his son in our lives. And we forget that sometimes. We sometimes forget that the kingdom is where we're going, but we get distracted by the car payments or the gutters that need cleaning or whatever, you know. And we forget, well, what's really important? And so many times we get distracted and diverted and confused about what's real and important. Now, I can talk to you till I'm blue in the face about this, and you can say, oh, yeah, I get that, I get. You leave here and you go out, it's gone. You forget. Sunday morning, you come to an exhortation, and you listen to this exhortation, and you say, whoa, yeah, that brother's right on the mark with that. I sure hope so-and-so's listening. That's how so often we think, you know. We're like Velcro men. Nothing sticks on us, it slides off. Eh? But you sure hope somebody else that you think needs the exhortation. Well, we've got to try and develop this vision. End of 2 Corinthians chapter 4. Because we see all the stuff that you can actually touch and hear and taste and think that's real, but it's not. "In the days of these kings shall the God of heaven establish a kingdom which shall never be destroyed." Now, we're on the verge of that happening. These turning points that we've considered, we are at a turning point. And that, are you getting ready for it? As in the days of Noah, as in the days of Lot, they just carried on. Life just went on. And they didn't think about what was really going to happen and what was really important in their lives. Really, what we're going to be considering in this next session is Caleb. We're going to be seeing these two spies that had the real vision. They could look beyond the Anakim, the giants, and they could see, well, if God is for us, who can be against us? So they got giants, so they got M48s or whatever they are. Well, no problem. We can handle that. This is the attitude that Caleb exhibits. And that's the attitude which we'd like to try and develop and think of in these turning points. As we've said, a whole generation is going to die as a consequence of the actions of the spies that came back from the land. And what I want us to think about is, well, why? Why did 10 think this and 2 think that? What motivated them? What lessons can we learn? And which ones do we want to copy? Which end results do we want to arrive at? So that's, I think, what I want to look at. Now, the events that we just looked at with Nadab and Abihu, as we've said, happened very close to the beginning of the wilderness wandering. And all these events are going to be kind of compressed really into a relative short time span. We're not talking about generations. We're not thinking that these things have happened over a very, very long period of time. Just one reference to pick up on this was Exodus chapter 40. One verse in Exodus chapter 40 to look at these events and try and again put them into some kind of sequence so that we can get a feel for how long a time period are we looking at or when these things took place. Verse 17 of Exodus chapter 40, we read this, just to remind us, Exodus chapter 40 and verse 14. It reads, and 41. Now I'll tell you, if I want to get my eyes checked. Chapter 40 and verse 17. Well, that's not right either, is it? I'm looking in the wrong spot for this little rascal. It's when, maybe it was 39. Oh dear. Anyway, Exodus chapter 40, I thought it was 40 in verse 17. This is when the tabernacle is erected. And this is when all these events that we looked at with Nadab and Abihu take place. Now, they're in the wilderness for 40 years, and we know that from the events that are recorded for us, that, it's not a confusing thing for us to try and figure out, but they're in the wilderness for 40 years. Okay, so that's how they're long in the wilderness. Okay, having got that and thinking about it, what we need to try and then figure out from this is, well, if they're there for 40 years, how long did they wander? How long did they actually wander after God said, well, you don't want to go in? Well, you're not going to go in and you're going to wander now. Well, we can look at this in a couple of spots to try and get a feel for it. The first one that I'd like us to look at is in Deuteronomy, which gives us how many years they wandered. Chapter 2 of Deuteronomy, Deuteronomy chapter 2. Again, we have this time frame put forward for us that I just want us to notice. It's chapter 2 and it's at verse 14. Deuteronomy chapter 2 and at verse 14. This is what we read. And he spake, and the space in which we came from Kadesh Barnea until we were come over the brook Zered was 38 years, until all the generation, even the men of war, were wasted out from among the host, as the Lord sware unto them. So 38 years they wander. They're in the wilderness for 40 years. So that means that the events at Kadesh Barnea, when they're prohibited from going into the land, it's only 2 years. It's only 2 years from the time when they have left Egypt, when the things which they have witnessed in Egypt, all the events, the amazing things. So the God which should be so real to them, who has delivered them, when they've seen the fire on Mount Sinai, when they've seen all the events happen, this is this generation. They're aware of these things. Well, how could you murmur? And how could you say, well, you know, what's happened to Moses? What has happened to this man? And all these, that's our human nature. Unless our feet are really held to the fire, if they cool off a little bit, we really go our own way and we do things which are not acceptable. And so these events that we're going to look at with the spies, you can see how close they are to the events that have happened after they've been delivered from Egypt. It's all in this first couple of years. So think of the events. Think of the plagues. How Israel was separated from Egypt. And these events took place not in the land of Goshen, but in the land of, you know, to get them to realize that God is for us. God has separated us. God wants us to be a special people unto him. You think of the Red Sea. You know, they think, well, this is it. The chariots are coming. We can hear them rumbling. Pharaoh's after us, and there's nowhere to go. And the waters open, and they cross, and they see all the host of Egypt, all his chariots and the mighty men swallowed up in the Red Sea. All those events have been demonstrated to this generation very clearly. They murmured, nothing to eat, nothing to drink. You think of the manna and of the quail and of the rock, of the waters that were open to them. And the events at Mount Sinai, which they witnessed, all these events have taken place very close to this generation. And yet, they don't think about it. They despise God's care and the provisions that he has made. And the people still complain, won't trust in God and recognize his hand in the events which are taking place. Now, who initiated the spies to go into the land? Well, when you go to Numbers 13, it seems as if these events took place at the instigation of the people. Now, perchance it was to a certain extent, and it looks very clear in Numbers chapter 13 at the beginning, or the first few verses of Numbers chapter 13 says, "And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Send thou men that they may search out the land of Canaan, which I have given unto the children of Israel. Of every tribe of their fathers shall ye send a man, every one, a ruler, a captain among them." So it sounds like, well, that's God's direction. He says that that's what they're supposed to do. Now, in Deuteronomy chapter 1, when Moses, as they're coming to go into the land, as he reviews the events that are taking place, he gives a slightly different, a slant to the events which took place when they came to enter into the land. And this is what he says in Deuteronomy chapter 1. I guess verse 19 of Deuteronomy chapter 1. "And when we departed from Horeb," they've now left Mount Sinai, "when we left from Horeb, we went through that great and terrible wilderness, which ye saw by the way of the mountain of the Amorites, as the Lord our God commanded us, and we came unto Kadesh Barnea. And I said unto you, Ye shall come unto the mountain of the Amorites, which the Lord our God doth give unto us." Now, you know, this is, you can see that what we're talking about here is these events where the spies are going to be sent into the land. You know, it's very clear. Look at verse 22. "And ye came near unto me, every one of you, and said, We will send men before and go up and search out the land and bring us word again by what way we must go up and unto what cities we shall come." So it would appear that the people are the one that want to actually see what the land is like, where to go and what to do. And God says to Moses, okay, if that's what they want, you send 12 men and let them go and spy out the land. Now, the reason they want to go and look is because they're not really sure. Well, I wonder where. God has given them this land. He said, this is your land. Here it is. But the people are the ones that seem to want to make sure. Are you sure that this is the right land? Is it okay to go in? Where should we go? Sometimes we get what we wish for or what we'd like. And afterwards we think, I wish I hadn't wished for that. You know, I don't really want that when we get it. In other words, what I'm saying in this is that God knows what we should do and where we should go. And rather than wishing for something which we think would be right, let's take what God gives to us and work with it and recognize that he knows the end from the beginning and he will work with us and things will work out in our lives. Well, the children of Israel, when they came to Kadesh Barnea, weren't sure whether God really was going to bring them in, and everything was going to go right, so they wanted to have a look at it. And God says, okay, if that's what you want here, this is the way I want you to do it. I want you to send 12 men. Don't just send one guy to have a look, or two guys. I want a captain, a leader from each of the tribes, so that you have an overall picture of what it's like and what's going to happen. Now, God knew from the beginning that they wouldn't give a good report, but he knew that two men of faith would stand out. Why? I would suggest that it's a lesson for all succeeding generations that we can be diverted by the things that we see. I can't do this. This is too hard. You know, God should be doing this to me. I don't deserve this. And what we're being demonstrated to us, I suggest, in this incident with the spies, is to trust in God. That God has called us. That God wants us. And there's nothing that will stop him fulfilling that if we let him work with us. If you were a lump of clay, I'm sure you would protest when the potter took you and decided, I want to straighten this well, and slapped you down. Oh. And when he squeezed you and pushed you here and shaped you and spun you, you'd say, well, Lord, what do you do? I don't want, you know. In Romans, it talks about the pot saying, why did you put handles on me? I didn't want handles. You know, who are we to say to God, look, you've made a mistake. This shouldn't be happening to me. God says, I know what I'm doing. Trust me, work with me, and I will make you a vessel which is fit for preservation. And we don't like to do that. We say, well, no, I think I know a bit better for this. Well, we're going to see this demonstrated in the actions of these people that we're going to look at in the incident with the spies. So these 12 men are sent. They are heads of the tribes. They're not kind of just gash hands that are picked up somewhere. And they go into the land and they all see the same thing. Back in Numbers chapter 13, just looking at these are not new things for you, but just to refresh our minds, they don't send one fellow over here and another fellow over there so that they all see different things. They all see the same things. Verse 21 of Numbers chapter 13. So these 12 men are now going into the land. So they went up and searched the land from the wilderness of Zin unto Rehob as men come to Hamath. And the ascent by the south, and came unto Hebron, where Ahiman, Shishai, and Talmai, the children of Anak, were. Now, Hebron was built 7 years before Zoan in Egypt. So they've all gone up, and they all see these things. That's what they see. They see giants, they see the land, they see what it's like. Now, these fellows that are outlined for us here are big men. They are giants. They are descendants of Anak. They are the Anakim. There are a bunch of these guys, and you'd look at them, and you'd, especially little vertically challenged people like me, our knees would be knocking. Ooh, those are big guys, you know. And as a consequence, what they see, they don't see beyond them. What they see, the tangible, they think is real. But they should see beyond that. There's only these two men that are going to see beyond the reality. But they see these big guys and they're scared of the things that might happen to them. Now they do decide that it's a good land. They all are unanimous on that. Look at verse 26 of this section. And they went and came to Moses and to Aaron and to all the congregation of the children of Israel and to the wilderness of Paran to Kadesh and brought back with them unto them and unto all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. And they told him and said, we came unto this land whither thou sentest us, and surely it floweth with milk and honey, and this is the fruit of it. Now that's what, you know, they saw. He said, it's a wonderful land. Look at the produce that it produces. You know, oh, yeah, that's a good report. That's a wonderful report. But verse 28, nevertheless, the people be strong and dwell in the land, and the cities are walled and very great. And moreover, we saw the children of Anak there. So, sure, Moses, it's a good land. It's a wonder. Look at it. But, nevertheless, there are these giants there, those big walled cities. Now, We're never going to do that. I mean, we're not people of war. We don't have battering rams. Our trebuchets are all kind of packed up. There's no way we can take this land. They forget what God has done for them in the last 38 years. He's preserved them. They've forgotten what happened when they left Egypt. And that's what they see. They see the things and they quake and they shake nevertheless. Now, it's the same for us. That God has invited us. He said, I want you to be a part of my family. And we've said, well, I'd like that, God. And he says, well, this is the process that I'd like you to go through. I'd like you to repent. I'd like to change your thinking and your actions. And I'd like you to be baptized and start a new life. And we've said, okay, Lord, yeah, I can do that. He says, okay, but I want you to conform to the pattern that I demonstrate to you in my son. I want you to change your lifestyle and your thinking. I want you to think differently and act differently. Now, that's when it gets hard. And we said, Lord, yeah, I can do the first part. You know, I have a good bath every now and again. But, you know, to actually change my thinking, and life, that's hard. And God says, I know it's hard, but I want you to do it. Now, that's what he's saying to the children of Israel now as they come to the borders of the land. Sure, there's giants there. It's a lovely land, isn't it? And we can see the kingdom. Wouldn't it be lovely to be in the kingdom? But he said, between now and the kingdom, I want you to change. Sure, there's giants, but with me on your side, nothing is impossible. I can do all things through Christ, which strengtheneth me. Well, these people had forgotten that exhortation. And we're going to see the disaster which it brings upon this generation. So this example that we have, is really to be worked out in our own lives. There's a reference in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. You probably know the reference before I get there. You know, that there has no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man. The Revised Version, I think, says that man can bear. So there's no temptation that's taken you that is not common to man that man can bear. But God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted above that you're able, but will with the temptation also make a way to escape that you may be able to bear it. Now, we know that verse. It's a little verse that you probably have plaques of it. You memorize it, that there is no temptation taken you, but such as is common to man, or that man can bear. Now, they couldn't take that. They couldn't accept that. That's the promise that God has made to us in the New Testament. That was the promise which is eternal. The promise which he made to the patriarchs all through the Old Testament, that there was nothing that was too hard for them to bear. I always think of Abraham. When God says to him, take your son, your only son, the one you love, and offer him for an offering on the mountains of Moriah. Now I'd say something like, oh, okay, Lord, I'm busy this week, but I think I can probably work a spot in. Now what does Abraham do? He gets up early in the morning to go about God's request, an awful request. And he doesn't know, he thinks, we'll go yonder and we'll come again. He is able to think that even though this is what God has asked me, somehow God's going to work this out. Now that's the kind of attitude that we have to try and develop in our lives. We don't understand. We don't quite realize what you're trying to do with me, Lord. He never gives you little labels on the problems that he gives to you. He just gives you them and he says, now I want you to take this. Figure it out. Think about it. When we moved to Prince George, we coveted a lot on the view side, beautiful lot. And we bought it. And we remortgaged the house. So that we had big mortgage payments because we had a lot now and a house that we'd bought. It wasn't astronomical mortgage payments, but it was when you're out of work. And, you know, in 82, the economy didn't do very well in Canada in general, in BC particularly, and I'm out of work. So we now have mortgage payments that were $950 a month. And EI doesn't stretch that far, you know. So what are you going to do? So you try and sell the lot. Okay. So you lower the price. And then you lower the price. So we sold it in the end. $17,000 less than we'd bought it for. Now, you think $17,000, that's a pittance from a $600,000 house I've got. You know, this house wasn't $600,000 we bought. And it's amazing. Afterward, you think, well, Lord, did we make a mistake somewhere here? Was the fleece supposed to be dry and the ground wet and we misread this? In other words, when we left Vancouver, you know, we put our house on the market And we ended up selling it for $10,000 more than we had. The guy phoned us up on the Monday. We'd gone to Bible school, actually, down to Manuka. And he phoned us up on the Monday morning, and he said, "Hey, I sold your house at the weekend, full price." He says, "But I'm not going to accept the offer because I think the market's kind of going up a bit." Phoned back on the Wednesday, and he'd sold it for another $10,000 more. I had a job line. Everything was fine. Went, "Oh, woo, woo, woo." But then all of a sudden, you know, you think, "Lord, did I misread something here? Now, why did that happen? Why did God do that?" There was no label. There was no little description as to what I'm doing here. So you think about it. Rightly or wrongly, the only thing we could come up with was 2 Timothy 6:6. That godliness with contentment is great gain. I wasn't content. You know, I didn't want this house. I wanted the one with the view. You know, when you wanted to build it and get the verandas and look out. I wasn't content. And I think, I don't know. To me, God was saying, godliness with contentment is great gain. You know, you've got all that you need. Why are you grasping and wanting more of this or more of that? Now, we don't know. We don't know why events happen in our lives. We don't understand. And I think sometimes what God is doing, he's trying to take your zipper and open it up so you can show what you're really like inside. Now, how would you react if God said to you, take your son, your only son, the one you love, and offer him for an offering? You'd say, "Oh, that's too hard." Now, God knew his man. He knew Abraham. But Abraham didn't know what he was like. You remember when the three angels have come to destroy Sodom. And you have that almost like a horse trading. What would you do it for 40? Well, how about 30? 30? And, you know, the thing goes down. Abraham doesn't know what God's mercy is really like. And in the end, we find the angels go in. And they take out those that are fit to be redeemed rather than saving the whole city. Now, that's what Abram didn't know. He was questioning, "Well, how merciful are you? What are you really like?" And he didn't recognize God's mercy when God said to him, "Take your son." Now, that same principle, that same thing happens in our lives. God knows what we really like. He knows how we would respond, but we don't. How are you going to respond when something really serious happens in your life, in your family's life? We don't know. We know what we would like to do. You know, they say to you, "Oh, a conscientious objector. Oh, what would you do if the army's in there and they're raping your wife? Would you just sit back and say, carry on?" Well, you know what you want to do. You don't know what you do. You can say, you know, what I really would like to do, but you don't know. And I think so often we don't know what we really like until push comes to shove. And you really have to show what you're like. And God puts you into situations where you can demonstrate it. Now, this is what's going to happen with these spies. They all see the same thing, and they all come back with a good report for the land, but. And we're so often like that. I'd love to do this, but. You know, there's a spot in the speaking appointments, and you've got nobody to fill it. Well, I'd really like to help you, but. You know, so many buts that we throw. We know what we would like to do, but. We're really busy that, or whatever. You know what I'm trying to say. We so often can see, but there are things that we would maybe like to do better or other places that we'd like to go. Now, this is what comes, the spies, when they come back, they have this kind of attitude. Now, two men see the invisible. Two men are able to see beyond this. Let's go back to our readings there back Numbers there to pick this up. Numbers chapter 14. We're going to see that these two men are able to see beyond, to recognize, no more buts. You're on our side, Lord. We can do these things. In verse 6 of chapter 13, Numbers chapter 13, verse 6, the background of these two men. Of the tribe of Judah, Caleb, the son of Jephunneh. So Caleb is from Judah. Now Joshua, down in verse 8, and of the tribe of Ephraim, Hoshea, the son of Nun. Now a little farther down, when you come down there, verse 16, Hoshea, the son of Nun, is described Jehoshua or Joshua. So here's the two men. And they are from the tribe of Judah and from the tribe of Ephraim. Now Ephraim, if we were to look at Hosea, Ephraim is the northern kingdom, is Israel. Ephraim and Israel are synonymous. Now Judah is the southern kingdom. So what you've got a picture of here, these two men, is the whole of Israel. You've got the northern kingdom of Israel, and you've got the southern kingdom of Judah, if you like, represented in these two men. Now, this picture that we've got here is really a picture of the whole Israel of God. It's not saying, well, these are the men, these ones, and these are the women, or these are the tall people, or these are, this is the whole of Israel. They are all kind of represented in these two men, which are the ones that can see with their eye of faith the invisible things. And what we want to focus on here is Caleb. Chapter 13, still in chapter 13, down to verse 30. Numbers 13 and verse 30. And Caleb stilled the people before Moses and said, "Let us go up at once and possess it, for we are well able to overcome it." Now, that's his attitude. And this fellow is not really a native-born Israelite. When you look at his pedigree a little bit, you find that he's a Kenite. And the Kenites' land was promised by God to be the inheritance of Israel back in, we won't go and look at it, in Genesis 16. So this is a fellow which has been adopted into the tribe of Judah and has kind of raised up in the ranks, if you like, to be the captain or to be the leader. He's the chief man of the tribe of Judah. Now that's the attitude and the character and the disposition of this man. Caleb, I think, is a wonderful man. He's not a native born. He's not a Jew by birth. He's been adopted into the tribe. What are we? Are we native born Jews? We are not. We have been adopted into the family of God. And the attitude that Caleb displays, I think, is a wonderful attitude for us to develop and to demonstrate in our lives. Now, carrying on from that, why does he think that way? You know, what is it that makes him think that, well, we can do this. There's no problem with this. We read verse 30 there, Numbers 13, verse 30. For we are well able to overcome it. Now, if you just, to me, it's just across the page into chapter 14 at verse 8. Numbers 14 and verse 8. This is what he says. If the Lord delight in us, then he'll bring us into this land and give it to us, a land which floweth with milk and honey. That's his attitude. Now, the contrast, if you flip back across the page to Numbers 13, to verse 31, because we read verse 30, look at verse 31. And the men that went up with him said, Oh, we be not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we. So somehow they could not see beyond. They could see the walled cities, they could see the giants, and they said, we can't do this. Well, sure, you can't do it. You can't do these things of your own strength and your own might. Now, Caleb could see beyond that. And he could see what God was working. He'd promised them. So, come on, guys. Get off the pot. Let's get going. We can well do this. We are well able because God is on our side. Now, they refuse to go in. The ten sway the multitude to say, no, we can't. Don't listen to Caleb. Don't listen to Joshua. They're talking a blue streak here that they don't know what they really mean. We can't go in. And so they refuse to go in, even despite all the evidence that's been given to them. So in chapter 14 at verse 1, Numbers 14 and verse 1, and all the congregation lifted up their voice and cried, and the people wept that night, and all the children of Israel murmured against Moses and against Aaron, and the whole congregation said unto them, would God that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would God that we died in this wilderness? And wherefore has the Lord brought us up into this land to fall by the sword, that our wives and our children should be a prey? Were it not better for us to return into Egypt? Now that was the attitude of the whole congregation, that they would rather go back. And in verse 4, and they said one to another, let us make a captain, and let us return into Egypt. Now that's what they want to do. Now, Nehemiah, in his account of this, suggests that they'd already made a captain. They'd all ready to go back. It's Nehemiah chapter 9. And maybe we can just quickly look at that to see that here, in Nehemiah, it tells us that it would appear that they'd already made a captain ready to go back to the land. It's Nehemiah chapter 9, a couple of verses out of Nehemiah chapter 9 that I want to look at. specifically to start off with verse 12, Nehemiah chapter 9 and verse 12, this is what he's recounting of this earlier event. Nehemiah 9 and verse 12, this is what we read. Moreover, thou leddest them in the day by a cloudy pillar, and in the night by a pillar of fire, to give them light in the way whereof they should go. So you can see that this is what Nehemiah is talking about, the wilderness wandering. Come down to verse 16. But they and our fathers dealt proudly and hardened their necks and hearkened not to thy commandment and refused to obey. Neither were they mindful of thy wonders that thou didst among them, but hardened their necks and in their rebellion appointed a captain to return to their bondage. And thou, a God ready to pardon, gracious and merciful, slow to anger and of great kindness, forsookest them not. It would appear from that little statement, I would suggest, that they had already appointed a captain to go back to the land. It wasn't just talk. Now, tomorrow, God willing, we're going to look at Korah, Dathan and Abiram. And I'm going to suggest that maybe this captain which they appointed was Korah, that he was the one that they figured would be a good, he'd be a good leader. He wouldn't go and do all this stuff that Moses is doing. He'd take us back there. That's the one that we want. I'm just suggesting that, as we look at Korah, Dathan and Abiram tomorrow, perchance you might think the same way. But it would appear from Nehemiah's, inspired account of these things that they had appointed themselves a captain to go back to the land. Now, if you flip back to Numbers chapter 14, God makes this amazing promise. Despite the things that they've done, he says, look, this is the promise that I make unto you. I'm looking at verse 21 of Numbers chapter 14. And we know these verses. This is verses that we spout so often. Numbers chapter 14 and verse 21. But as truly as I live, the Revised Standard Version says, but as truly as I live, and as all the earth shall be filled with the glory of the Lord, none of these men which have seen my glory and my miracles which I did in Egypt and in the wilderness and have tempted me now these 10 times and have not hearkened to my voice, surely they shall not see the land which I swear unto their fathers, neither shall any of them that provoked me see it. But my servant Caleb, because he had another spirit with him and hath followed me fully, him will I bring into the land whereunto he went, and his seed shall possess it. So because of their hard-hearted, stubborn ways, God says, you're not going to go in. But Caleb and Joshua, but specifically Caleb we're looking at here, will go in and will inherit that land. Now, that same indomitable spirit which is portrayed as we've looked at, let us quickly go in. When he's an old man and they're going into the land, and we're now looking at Joshua. This is the same chapter, actually. Numbers 14 and Joshua 14 portray the same events. And I want you to notice what happens when they're going into the land, actually going into the land with Joshua. Caleb is still there and Joshua is leading them. And Caleb is one of those that is going in. And I think it's so interesting to see what Caleb says as they come into the land. Joshua chapter 14, start at verse 6. Joshua 14 and at verse 6. Then the children of Judah and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh the Kenite, or Kenizzite, said unto him, thou knowest the thing that the Lord said unto Moses, the man of God, concerning me and thee in Kadesh Barnea. 40 years old was I when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to spy out the land. And I brought him word again, as it was in my heart. I didn't fabricate. This is just, that's the way it was. That's how I saw it. That's how I felt. Nevertheless, my brethren that went up with me made the heart of the people melt. But I wholly followed the Lord my God. Now that was his attitude, and that's what he displayed, and that's the way he went. Now, these 10 spies, if we went back to Numbers, died by the plague that the Lord sent upon them. They didn't just live out their days until they died of old age. God killed them because of their rebellion and because of their words, which made a whole generation to wander in the wilderness until all that nation had died out. Still in Joshua chapter 14, look at verse 12. Joshua 14, verse 12. Now therefore, give me this mountain whereof the Lord spake in that day, for thou heardest in that day how the Anakim were there, and that the cities were great and fenced. If so be the Lord will be with me, then I shall be able to drive them out, as the Lord said. He doesn't say, give me, no, it's not like Lot, look at the plain, oh, it's well watered everywhere, let's go down to Sodom. He says, I want the mountain where the giants are, where the walled cities are. Because if God's on my side, it's game over. These guys haven't got a hope. They haven't got a chance. Now, that's his attitude. That's the vision that he had. He didn't look at the stuff that he could touch and taste and see. He saw beyond it. He was able to get in his mind that there's no temptation taking you but such as is common to man. I will not leave thee nor forsake thee. Now, that was implanted in his heart. He didn't have to make it up. He didn't have to think, well, what am I going to do? He spake and he acted as what was in his heart. And that's like, it's like the keynote that runs through any time that you run across Caleb, that he sees the invisible and he works that way. So, what do we want to learn from this little session together, looking at the spies going into the land? We want to develop that vision that these men of God had. It didn't matter about giants. It didn't matter about the hardships and the difficulties. They knew that God would never leave nor forsake them, that all things work together for good to them that love God and are called according to his purpose, and that we can see the invisible things and work toward that way. And we pray, God, that the example of Caleb and of Joshua, and the example that we've seen of those 10 spies that could only see the here and now, that we refuse that and we cleave toward the events that Caleb and Joshua portray for us, and praying that our God would soon come, and that he'd see those reflections in our lives. Thank you.